All right, we are back. Thank you so much for sticking with us and joining us today. And now, as always, my favorite part of the show, get to pick somebody else's brain, and you get to hear from somebody other than me. So it's not just me shouting at you through a radio. Anyway, a good friend of the show and a good personal friend of mine, somebody whose research that we rely on, one of the few guys that I pay for research. And I really, you know, in this business, I don't really know how to compliment somebody more than that in terms of the quality of their work. So Mr. Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro. Anyway, Chase, I'm kind of setting things up for you and hopefully not in putting too much pressure on you, man. But I appreciate all the work you've done, and I also appreciate you coming on the show again.
Yeah, you bet. And pressure makes diamonds, so no worries.
Well, it bursts some pipes too, man. I got the scars to prove it. Anyway, well, kind of doing a year-end macro review, and one of the reasons I wanted to get you on here is, you know, your macro research has been really beneficial to us. You're our macro guy, man. This is who we listen to, and obviously plenty of fireworks this year, plenty to discuss on the macro level, and then wanted to kind of get into you know, what we see coming in the year ahead, and you know, hit some highlights of this year. But let's just start off where I wanted to just hear where you think we're at. You're looking at the data, you're researching this stuff exhaustively, which I'm sure your wife never tires of. just kind of give me an update, because the way I look at it is we're in a bit of a weird place. You got markets and asset prices going ballistic, brand new all-time highs. You got unemployment, you know, still way higher than it should be. And you still see this giant chasm between the U6 and the official job numbers. So let's go kind of give me your update about where we are on a macro level right now, as it relates specifically to the United States economy. And then also, if you could work in kind of an explanation, just for my own edification, of, you know, and I know that there's a gap there, but what is the issue with the U6 number and the real unemployment number, and why is there such a chasm, and has there been this bounce back in employment numbers that the unemployment levels, the current unemployment levels, would lead you to believe?
Yeah, so it's definitely been a crazy year. You could pretty much recap 2020 by saying everything went down, then everything went up. But as far as unemployment goes, I actually tune out a lot of the headline numbers that come through. But the reality, like why the unemployment rate looks low, is just the way it's calculated. If someone, you know, has been out of the workforce for a long enough period of time, they just deem that they're not in the workforce and they don't count against unemployment. So because of all that, I try to just look at basic employment versus population versus the working age population, and just that super non-seasonally adjusted, you know, not stopping counting people that clearly still want to work. And that, to me, that's a better way to kind of keep an eye on it. That as well as how many people are claiming unemployment benefits. And we still have 20 million people that are getting unemployment benefits of one type or another. So that does tell you that, you know, the labor market is still has a long ways to go, which, I mean, you know, makes sense. We're still dealing with the pandemic, so that's not a surprise. But it does make a difficult chasm between, you know, the real economy for a lot of people and then, you know, the financial economy that obviously is, you know, roaring right now. And it's roaring for, you know, people that are able to work on a laptop at home. You know, for those of us that can do that, you know, everything's fine. We're just, you know, people are getting, you know, stimulus checks. They don't have to spend money on gas. And, you know, there is really a lot of pent up demand for those people. But on the flip side, you know, there's 20 million people, they're small business owners that have lost everything or in the process of losing everything. We've seen tons of cash out refinancing for homes. And, you know, I think a part of that is just, you know, rates are really low, so it makes sense to refinance. But I think, you know, a lot of small business owners that maybe, you know, had a restaurant or a bar or a gym or something, you know, they just lost their livelihood. So they probably had to grab some equity out of their house just to get by for the next year. And that's really unfortunate. But yeah, as far as, kind of a zoomed out view of where we're at and where we're headed. I think that sort of K-shaped recovery where, one leg is doing great and one leg is doing poor that's going to stick around for a little bit longer. But as we look at the economy, as an aggregate next year, it's going to look like we're in just a massive boom, I think, especially, as you compare it to where we were at the same periods in 2020, it's going to look like a huge boom.
Okay, so how do you square that with, some good buddies of ours, some guys whose research and information, or the way they look at the world that I respect, really kind of throwing shade on that view, saying there is going to be no reflation, that trade it's a rumor. How do you combat that? Because I find myself, and I think it's important to point out that. And I think that you and I agree on this, but, I see it much the same way. I think that you're going to see what looks like a boom. I don't think it's going to be a boom in the way that we typically think about it. Like the economy is just roaring, but, I personally think it's going to be a little more aesthetic, that you're going to see certain sectors like housing continue to rock and roll. I think you'll see a big uptick in commodities, and we're starting to see evidence of that now. And something I've been playing with is kind of the word sinflation, like synthetic inflation, meaning that I think you're going to see it in very select areas and then not at all in others. How do you square this view that you and I have much more on our side with those guys saying that, this is just another reflation head fake? How do you square our view with that? And then also, what do you think about that quote unquote sin? And what by that, I mean, synthetic S-Y-N. What do you think of that look, or what I'm looking at in terms of expecting that spotty inflation?
Sure. So that is a perfect way of explaining, I think, with inflation, because I have a really nuanced view of inflation right now. And I think both sides are kind of right. It's all about timing. So I don't think we're going to get, some new bout of real lasting structural inflation yet. But I think, but people that don't think we're going to get some reflation in 2021 are just not paying attention. Like, it's just based on base effects. Like, if you look at Q2, Q3, where we had, a lot of deflation coming in, and you compare prices to that period, same with GDP, same with earnings, that stuff's all just terrible for Q2, Q3. So when you do a year-over-year comparison, it's all just going to look really, really big. We're going to have headline inflation over 3% at some point in probably Q3. So we're going to have reflation, and you can see it, like you say, and we're already seeing a lot of commodities break out. You go pull up a chart of really any industrial metal, any agricultural commodity that's out there, and it's going higher. And the dollar, is well off its highs. So if the dollar keeps leaking lower, and I think it will, that just kind of adds a lot of fuel to the fire of that reflation. But the flip side of that is, I think a lot of people are saying, oh, MMT's here, the big inflation's here. We're going to start, really having this major inflation problem. And I don't think we get that until we are extremely irresponsible fiscally, and not just in an emergency, but when things look pretty good and we're just you know what, things are pretty good, but whatever, let's still go out and have a $2 trillion deficit. That's when we would get high inflation, because there's so many structural forces that are deflationary that whenever we get into 2022 and all those base effects wear off, that's when it gets tough to have inflation, especially if the GOP is still controlling the Senate and they, tighten up the purse strings, then all of a sudden all this inflation we got in 2021 just starts to kind of fade away. So to me, it's all about kind of that sequence of how you see the timing play out. We definitely get reflation in 2021. And then going into 22, it depends on what's the dollar doing and what are policymakers doing. If the GOP is a lot more spin happy than maybe consensus thinks, then yeah, we will continue to get inflation into 2022. And at that point, maybe you do see, kind of the real structural shift after, 40 years of kind of deflation just getting a little lower, or inflation and just getting a little lower, a little lower, a little lower. The whole 40 years, you start to see that bottom and actually turn higher. So really, it's just a timing thing. But as far as next year goes, we're going to have high growth. Earnings are going to look good for a lot of people, and we're going to get some inflation.
Yeah, no, that's pretty much in line with the way we see it. Anyway, we got to take a quick break. Give us a call, 866-779-RISK. We'll be right back with our interview with Chase Taylor. Don't miss it. This is Know Your Risk Radio podcast on Know Your Risk Radio. All right, we are back. Thank you so much for sticking with us. Anyway, without further ado, let's get to the interview. Mr. Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro. Now, do you think... Is all of this extraordinary monetary policy and you know, unprecedented action of central banks and government intervention and stimulus, is it going to make us just go right over the top of this whole bump? And I don't mean to minimize it because I know it's impacted a lot of lives, but is, in retrospect, is coronavirus just going to look like a bump, or are we going to have to actually deal with the reality of the damage that's been done to the economy at some point? I mean, are they just able to fill in that pothole and just move us right down the road? Because now, full disclosure, I don't think so. I think the bill always comes due, and I think it always comes due in every way. Yet at the same time, at this point, to me, it looks like, you know, I guess it's feasibly possible that they're just able to print over the top of it and we go on our merry way this year and growth accelerates. And is it that simple? Are we just going to take off from here?
I kind of think we are. Getting back a lot of the hole that was dug out really comes down to, can all these policies actually put, you know, that 20 million people back to work in a reasonable amount of time? That's the real question. There's been a lot of debt added, you know, to government balance sheets, corporate balance sheets, to household balance sheets. Like, a lot of people have had to kind of lever up to get through this. So if you don't get these people back to work, get, you know, the economy as a whole moving again, if you don't, see demand like really come back, then it's going to be a struggle. But let's say, you know, they get this next stimulus passed and then maybe we get another one at some point in 21, even if it's small. And you see that 20 million people start going back to work, you know, at a clip of a million a month or something, then I think we do make a major comeback, and a lot of the ill effects of this, you know, in a way start to wear off. But then, you know, everyone's going to have to start servicing their debt, and you know, some people that lost, you know, everything have a lot of building back up to do. So we see huge excess savings in the economy now because there's been so much stimulus put in people's pockets and a lot of people haven't consumed. So when, you know, those people go out and like really start putting that money to work, if that money getting put to work kind of helps the people out that, you know, got hurt the worst, then yeah, I think it could be surprising how well the economy does in 2021. There's definitely going to be some scarring because this thing was so bad. But at the aggregate level, like I think you can see a major comeback, because I really do think there is significant pent-up demand, people wanting to get out and travel, wanting to go out. You know, everyone's bought durable goods. Like, the people that haven't been hurt by this probably bought, you know, new appliances and put a deck on their house and things like this. You know, like, next year they're going to want to turn that into more like services. You know, they're going to go on a vacation and go get a massage again and go to the gym, things that they haven't been able to do this year. To answer the basic question, yes, I think we can largely get past all this without, at least in 2021, not really seeing, you know, the hangover. 2022, that's where like the real possibility, the hangover kind of setting in, I think will show up.
Yeah, there's another one that I'm working on, and I've heard other people say similar things. So if you've heard other people say similar, I'm not trying to, you know, plagiarize their thoughts, if you will, or make them my own. The other thing that's interesting to me, though, is I'm really interested, obviously, what happens on the fiscal side, because I think you agree with me, but I think everything is predicated on the fact that the spigot stays open. That they keep printing, and one of the interesting things I've seen with this stimulus bill now you know, it's been thrown to the side now, or I guess it's still possible, isn't it? Doesn't technically Trump have like till the 29th to sign the existing bill, or has he already vetoed? Is it gone?
So he hasn't. The last I saw, he hasn't vetoed it, and like literally nobody knows what he's going to do with it. Even the folks closest to him in the White House aren't really sure what he's going to do. But a lot of the benefits end in like 2 days. The government would shut down in 2 days if they didn't do another continuing resolution. So if he's going to sign it, he needs to sign it in the next day or two, or they're going to, you know, it's going to get weird again.
It's going to get weird. That's a good way to put it. anyway, what I was looking for was, you know, call me skeptical, but I'm not totally comforted and confident in the intelligence, especially as it relates to financial markets and economics of the quote unquote best and brightest we have leading our country in D.C. And I really think when they started making the negotiation and the level of that stimulus bill, you know, came out to be $900 billion. I'm kind of sitting there laughing, going, it kind of seemed to me like that moment in Jaws, you know, where they go, we're going to need a bigger boat. I'm looking at it and going, guys, I really think that you're getting led astray by the stock market, that you're going to need more than $900 billion. That ain't going to cut it. So one of the interesting things I'm looking at is if that disconnect stays there, I think you could see a big letdown or kind of a secondary, you know, I don't want to call it a double dip because I hate people using these terms because we're in such an unusual place. I think referring to it a double dip is just as stupid as saying that we're out of the recession. You know, it's like, well, yeah, right. you're clawing back to previous levels. You're still significantly below them. But I think a big risk is policymakers getting overconfident and seeing a lapse in the second half, kind of seeing things slough off. Do you think that's possible?
I think it is. But I don't think it'll really show up in like the headline numbers just because, you know, it was so bad this year. But I definitely know what you're talking about. And there, you know, we almost had a $1.8 trillion stimulus. Democrats wanted like $3.5 trillion. To me, Nancy Pelosi really screwed up not taking the $1.8 when it was offered. And, you know, now we're getting half that. And this does, in my opinion, leave some big holes out there that are going to be a drag on the economy, especially state and local governments. I mean, they're, you know, they're all in really bad shape because of what's happened. And I don't see, you know, them recovering enough, you know, in 2021 to like really get a lot of projects back up, get a lot of people back to work. You know, one of the things we always hear is people calling for infrastructure. And what I don't think people realize is most infrastructure spending happens, you know, on a basic state and local level. So even if the federal government does a big stimulus, say they did one next year, all it would really do would be fill in the massive cuts from the state governments not doing a bunch of their pre-planned, you know, building they were going to do. So when states are broke, they have to like start cutting real, you know, real spending, real services that hurts the economy. And if they don't get some federal support, and I totally understand if people, you know, are politically against that, I get the argument, but just from an economic standpoint, if they don't get federal support, they're going to be a drag on the economy. They were in the last, you know, the 08 crisis. That was one of the things that Ben Bernanke talked about. Like the one thing we really messed up was not getting more help to the states because they were a massive drag on the overall economy for years after that recession. And I think we'll be in that same situation here. And that's just, you know, that's one aspect that we're kind of leaving out of the current stimulus, you know, that we potentially were going to put into previous, you know, iterations that were much higher cost. But I think, you know, now it's just harder to do, you know, some massive stimulus now that, you know, we can kind of see the end of the coronavirus. I think the Republicans, you know, they have political reasons to pull back now. And, you know, you're kind of losing the emergency cover to do something, you know, really, really expensive. So there's a good chance we don't spend enough. And that is a weight on the economy. I still think 2021, just because, you know, when you compare Q3, especially to last year's, it's going to look great, even if the economy is actually sluggish. But 2022 comes, you know, all those weights that are kind of hanging on, they're all sitting there waiting after, you know, the giant sugar rush wears off of all the pent-up demand exploding, you know, in 2021. So I think everyone's going to kind of underestimate what can happen in 21 and then overestimate 2022 personally.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We got to take a quick break, but stick with us. And guys, as always, call us if you want to know how we're managing risk, if you want to know how we're lowering cost, increasing upside potential, and managing, most importantly, and I think this is going to be the most important thing over the next 2 years, unfortunately, it's managing that downside risk. If you want to know how we're doing that while lowering fees and actually increasing upside potential, Give us a call, 866-779-RISK, again, 866-779-RISK. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back. Stick with us. This is Know Your Risk Radio podcast on Know Your Risk Radio. All right, we are back. Thank you so much for sticking with us. Anyway, without further ado, let's get to the interview. Mr. Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro. One of the things that I think has held up remarkably well in the interviews that you and I did either late August or September, this was even back in May, where we were saying, look, they're going to open up the economy. The Fed has poured a ton of money into this. You're going to see GDP jump. You're going to hear Trump out there saying, oh, it's the best quarter of growth we've ever had. And, here we come. And I see those scenarios playing out a lot next year as well, like you're saying, just because the comps are so bad.
Yeah.
And the reason why I think that's key, Chase, is because, let's face it, we're in a market and an economy, and this has always mattered to some degree, so I'm not trying to say that this is something new, but let's face it, we are in an economy and in a market and at a point in our culture, actually, culture-wide, where, you know, I think that the image, if you will, or the comps, if you will, or the window dressing, or the I don't know the right way to say it, the symbolism that people are more paying attention to, like I said, the window dressing of the economy, that people really aren't worried about profits and profitability and numbers. And because of that, I just think that the optics of next year will GDP up 7% year over year. You got a market trade, this market clearly does not care about fundamentals. And anybody tries to make the argument that they do, I don't really know what to say to those people. Did you just kind of see that continuing, like you said, with the comps? Because CNBC's look at the quarter year over year growth. Profits are so much better year over year compared to Q3. Nobody's sitting there looking at those. I shouldn't say nobody, but overall, the market is not sitting there looking at those numbers and really doing hard analysis, going back and saying, well, yeah, you got a bump, guys, but it's because the economy's, opened up. We're still significantly below 2019 levels. Do you kind of see? I just think that the optics look good going into next year. The comps look good. And I don't really think anybody else cares about anything else. Do you?
No. What's interesting to me is, like, obviously, this year, the economy has been terrible, but financial markets have done great. And the one thing I feel like not enough people are considering is the possibility that next year is kind of the opposite, where, the economy comes roaring back, and yeah, maybe like cyclical stocks that got crushed, like they do great. But what could be the enemy of, financial market success is economic success, where, we start doing great in the economy, and if rates rise on the back of the economy, like really getting hot and inflation, perking up, then all of a sudden, a lot of the things that did great this year, the growthy names, the bubbles and SPACs and EVs and big tech, things like that, all of a sudden, one of the reasons they did great is because, the economy was coming back and rates didn't care. They weren't moving. So people were still just discounting, their future cash flows against nothing, against air. So you could basically value all that stuff to infinity. But, if rates start backing up, next year, let's say the 10 or the 30 year gets, or the 10 gets up to like 1.5-2% or something, then all of a sudden you can't, discount Tesla against air. You have to discount it against something real. And not to just pick on Tesla, there's dozens of similar cases of equities that went parabolic on the back of, these trends. So I do think, there could be a scenario where what's great for the economy all of a sudden isn't great for especially a lot of the winners of this past year. So you get this weird scenario where everything flips on its head from one year to the next. And the other thing that people I think should at least watch out for is a lot of the longer term trends that have been working could be, turning now, and, things like the dollar and U.S. outperforming, everything for the last, decade, that could all flip on the back of this as well.
Yeah, no, there's definitely some sea changes going on. One of the things that you talked about, we talked about a surge in corporate profits. I don't really, again, if we look at Q2 to Q3 and even Q1 to some degree, I think you'll see improvement, but you know, we've done a lot of work on Boeing, and I got into back and forth with somebody on Twitter about Boeing, and his whole thesis was, oh, this is all, you know, gloom and doom. Air travel will come back. Boeing will sell planes. And I said, listen, man, I agree with you. I don't think the airline industry is going away. As a matter of fact, I think in 2 years, especially on the retail side of it, you know, I think things will be back to pretty much normal, would be my thought. I do think that business travel is going to be hampered for a while, if not somewhat permanently. It's too easy of an expense to cut, especially in the light of going through COVID. But anyway, getting back to Boeing, the one albatross to me that I just don't see people paying attention is the debt that's been incurred on these balance sheets. And going back to this discussion I was having online with this guy, I don't disagree with your fundamental take, but you're not taking into account the fact that Boeing has got $41 billion of new debt on their balance sheet, and they've got an average financing cost of that debt right around 5%. You know, so you do the numbers, and you're looking at an additional $2.3 billion worth of debt servicing cost they're going to have to pay. And so even if you got a return back to record profits for Boeing, which in 2018 was, you know, $10.8 billion, that's going to be $8 billion by default, right? It's going to be 20% lower. And you look across a lot of these balance sheets, you know, you got record corporate debt issuance. Debt issuance is up 56% year over year. And it's not like we were dealing with unlevered balance sheets last year. So do you think people are taking account into these forecasts of corporate profit? It just doesn't seem like they're taking the debt seriously. Do you think they are? Do you think I'm wrong? And do you think that corporate profits rebound in spite of that? And somehow am I being too negative, I guess?
That's a good question. And I do think people are kind of sleeping on, you know, how much damage has happened to a lot of these balance sheets. And I think, you know, we're entering a period where stock picking is going to matter again. And balance sheets, you know, will matter again, especially if rates do, you know, 2% is nothing for interest rates, but still compared to where it is now, it's something. So if we do get back up to 2%, then all of a sudden, you know, you got to, and spreads are super tight right now. If that backs up a little bit, you know, then you really have to start taking those things seriously. I know I do. Like, you know, I've invested a lot of money, as you know, in oil companies this year. And, you know, in the depths of the pain for oil, it was a scary prospect. And, you know, it's like, you don't know when it's going to come back. So you kind of have to go do some work on the balance sheets and realize, like, yes, I want to get long oil equities, but do I want, you know, the company that has to borrow a bunch of money just to pay its dividend? They're like, probably not, you know, I'll get a little bit of that one, but, you know, finding these cyclical companies that actually have good management and a reasonable balance sheet, is, I think, it's going to be, you know, those companies will really outperform. A lot, good example, there's actually a Canadian based oil company that has zero debt on its balance sheet, which when you think about what's happened to oil in the last 5-10 years, to realize that there is a company out there that's good enough management and discipline to have zero debt going into what's probably going to be a generational turn higher, you know, for their industry. And you realize how much money they're going to make and what they can do with their capital versus, you know, an Exxon, which, don't get me wrong, I own Exxon too, but an Exxon that has had to borrow billions and billions and billions of dollars, maintaining their, you know, giant dividend for some reason. It's things like that where I think, you know, people are going to start noticing, like, oh man, this, you know, this company that took out billions of debt is kind of being sluggish this year, you know. And to me, it's going to make sense, but I think you could still see where no one cares because they just look at the comps on earnings and they're like, hey, everything's good again. And they just kind of ignore the debt situation. But my guess is, you know, these cyclicals that make the best comebacks are going to be the ones that, you know, were smartest with their balance sheets. So, you know, we're talking about airlines, you know, I think Southwest has been, you know, a lot better with their balance sheet than some of their competitors. So my guess is they'll they'll rip a lot more whenever everything goes back to being good. Just as an example. But yeah, when I look at, Boeing, the biggest thing they have going for them is they're kind of a giant monopoly and they get a lot of government support. So from that standpoint, obviously they're not going anywhere. And they don't, it's not like they're really going to lose out to, their competitors because they don't really have any other than, international markets. They have some, but yeah, to me, like adding that much, debt to your balance sheet, it matters. And I think, I don't, no one really got punished this year for selling a bunch of stock. I don't know why they'd all just didn't sell stock instead of debt, but.
Well, you know what? That's the fascinating thing about Boeing, and I, again, I'm not trying to beat up on Boeing. I know I focus on it. I just think it's such a poster child for so many of the problems out there. For instance, the biggest driver by far for Boeing, in their run up to that $440 share price was the stock buybacks. They bought back $50 billion worth of stock. Well, they just essentially undid it all, right? With the $41 billion that they had. I mean, they just basically wiped that out. And that was my whole point on Boeing. I said, look, if now in this market, could Boeing not even come close? Could they not even recover so much as, let's say, 50% of their profits from their record high and still end up, having, getting back to $400 a share? I mean, yeah. I mean, you've got Tesla with a $650 billion market cap. I mean, it's possible. But, you've got to, you'd have to, your thesis would have to be, look, the stock's going to go up besides, in spite of financial reality. And it's not a bet that I'd like to make. But it's just fascinating to me because I was sitting there going, look, you're going to have this scenario where they've either going to have to carry this $2.2 billion drag, on their cash flow statement for out into perpetuity, or they're going to have to sell stock. Right. And either way, it just amazes me, Chase, that people want to get long these things, especially with the bounce back they've had, where you're looking at them on a financial basis going, I'm sorry, that's not going to happen, right? Your bounce back scenario for this company, it's not mathematically feasible. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I wanted to get to the oil conversation because I think that you and I, well, I don't think, I know that we have similar outlooks on the energy markets, that as a value investor, the disdain with which the energy markets are looked at, the whole divesting policy with, funds and endowments to get rid of energy and all that kind of stuff. I love that, right? It's the perfect value setup for a sector. The only question I have is I do not understand the level of negativity with more mainstream and smart guys, smart investors. I don't agree with them, but there's a lot of thought out there and a lot of talk about, look, I don't care what you think is going to happen to oil. You can't touch these energy stocks. One of the things that worries me, Chase, and I wanted to get your feedback is, and let me get a little bit conspiratorial for a second. so don't write me off, people. Hear me out on this. the negativity surrounding the energy companies only makes sense to me if you believe that a Biden administration, as well as pop culture in general, as it relates to investing and finance, is determined to just get rid of these companies, to just get rid of fossil fuel. Outside of that, and I know they're determined, but realistically, they can't. I mean, you and I both know that. And anybody that's done any level of research would know that. But how do you explain the bearish sentiment? Again, I always approach these situations when I think the setup looks so good, and I see other people who are accomplished investors on the other side of it. I have learned to not have the knee-jerk reaction of, oh, they're just idiots, right? I've learned to sit there and think about the possibility that they know something you don't know. Do you think that's the case with oil right now? And if not, is it just the classic, we don't like it here, but we'll want to buy it when the stocks are 50% higher?
Yeah, and I definitely think you'll see that. The way I see oil or energy in general is we're stuck in a sort of a narrative vortex on it where, everyone that's bearish is mostly bearish because they've just got sucked into the consensus of green's going to take over everything. We're not going to need fossil fuels. And you know, a lot of times narratives will win out for many years at a time before, to me, like reality and facts take over. And this is, to me, is just a giant narrative versus facts situation. I've done just an unbelievable amount of research and math, and just the math on how this all, you know, shakes out energy wise. And it's, I think if you put the work in on that, it becomes just plainly obvious that we can't get away from fossil fuels. And even if we could, it probably wouldn't be that smart. Just there's not enough, there's just not enough capacity to, you know, really move to a renewable and green energy world in any sort of short time frame. And, you know, 10 years from now, there's going to be about a billion more human beings on the planet, and we can't even transition in 10 years. So there's obviously still going to be just, you know, incredible demand for fossil fuels. They're sort of, you know, miraculous energy producing, you know, substances that we should really be thankful we have. But I totally get, you know, the argument for trying to get away from those, you know, as best we can and in the smartest ways we can, you know, for, you know, lowering emissions. It totally makes sense. It's just when you do the math on populations, on, you know, the growth that we're going to get in, you know, middle classes in places like Asia, India, you know, like the middle class is going to explode in those places, and you get a very nonlinear demand for energy whenever you get growing middle classes in those countries. So energy demand's not going anywhere. It's going to keep moving higher. And a lot of the, in my opinion, crazy forecasts we see for, there's people that have literally called for oil demand to have already peaked. And there are some that say, you know, it hasn't peaked yet, but it's barely going to go a little bit higher, maybe 5% higher, and then they'll peak out and we're done. And I just think if you really spend the time on that and do the math on it, that you just can't, you know, you can't agree with that.
Chase, but, I don't understand how you even come to that conclusion, unless you think that, I mean, unless you're projecting no economic growth out of the future, where in the world is this narrative coming from? I mean, I don't get it.
Some of it comes from the oil industry, especially in Europe. You look at BP had a, what's infamous now in the industry, a kind of slide deck. They're kind of getting away from oil and they're trying to get into renewables, which in my opinion, you're doing that at the exact wrong time. But, in their slide deck, they had a lot of forecasts, and they're one of the ones that one of their forecasts is basically like, oh, we're done. Like we've peaked out. But even the investment banks are getting onto this trend of, you know, they'll model it out as like a best case and a worst case. And then, you know, the middle scenario. And I think even their like best case for fossil fuels is not, you know, not nowhere close to what reality will be. I think over the years, we've always increased energy, or specifically oil demand, by about 1% a year. And I just think that will continue to happen personally. You know, it's just, especially as, you know, we get more and more economic growth in emerging markets.
And the supply, you know, it's the supply destruction. I mean,
absolutely.
Look what I mean, shale. That this is the whole thing I don't understand. If you think you're going to have a resurgence of economic growth, if you believe in an economic backdrop, I just don't get how you get the numbers when considering the supply destruction. And it's so funny. There's been so much work and talk on this, Chase, and yet I hear people continue to talk and address a lot of these shale companies as if they're light switches. We get back to 60, they're just going to crank up the pumps again. And you go, you don't understand this. There's going to be hundreds of millions, if not more, of CapEx that would be needed to get shale back online. Right? I mean,
yes. So there's been no spending really on that. Like the amount of CapEx that would be that's needed is huge. We've had a just absolute destruction in investment in oil. We've had an absolute destruction in discoveries of new large oil fields. So if we just stopped looking for oil in a lot of ways. If you look at how much we used to look for it versus now, I mean, you're down like 80-90% from the way we used to do that. Same with, you know, the spending, the investment we're putting into, you know, like the infrastructure, the capital used to be. So we went from like, you know, you can easily just get bank capital, no problem, to do all this shale stuff. And then whenever that kind of soured, private equity came in and just threw a bunch of good money after bad, you know, and they just got burnt. So when oil went negative and everyone had to stop pumping in 2020, banks changed the way they lend. It used to be like a reserve-based model where you just said, like, how much oil do you have in the ground? Cool, we'll lend you money based on that. Well, they started realizing that, okay, well, like, if you can't get any of that out of the ground profitably, why in the world would I keep lending it to you just based on how much you have? Like, that doesn't make any sense. So a lot of the banks stopped doing that. Private equity got smoked, so a lot of them are leaving, realizing that all shale does is burn cash. Even when you're at $70, $80, they were burning cash, outside of, a couple of the really good ones. So as far as them trying to raise money, that whole situation has changed for them. And this is all, looking at the fact that into the fact that we have just an enormous supply gap moving forward. You look out to about 2030, and you're looking at 40 million barrel a day gap right now that they'll have to somehow fill. So you, and again, we're not investing, we're not looking for it like the way we used to. You have major oil companies like BP, Shell. They're saying, like, hey, we're going to dial back what we're doing with oil because, the world's changing. We'll all be driving Teslas powered by the sun soon. So it's again, it's narrative versus facts.
No, and it's funny you bring that word up because, there's guys like Ben Hunt that have done, extensive work on narratives and focused on it. But I continue to be absolutely amazed and baffled by the role that narrative has taken. I mean, in this market especially, narrative has absolutely trumped fundamentals and for quite a while now. And I listen to these green energy guys. I was reading a study recently, Chase, that, and you, again, you probably can speak to this in greater depth than I can. But reading a study that's saying, listen, we don't even have to project things out into the future, or we don't even have to, project what the carbon emissions would be, of an SUV for 10 years versus an EV, that literally just the act of plugging in the EV, the way that the vast majority of them in this country are powered, is that whole thing is emitting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than if you were just driving an internal combustion engine. Like, so literally, if these people are right and get a whole conversion over into EVs, that's going the wrong way, right? I mean,
Yeah. And especially if you think about a place like China where, I mean, they have great EV sales, but guess what? Their grid's coal. Coal burns way dirtier than, natural gas or obviously nuclear. So
even oil.
if you just plug in your EV into coal, then you're doing no one, you're not doing the environment any favors. And a lot of the US grid is not super clean, and so and if you want cobalt and lithium and all the things that go into this, or you look at, you actually need coal to build, solar panels. You need a lot of stuff to build solar panels, and you got to get it out of the ground. You don't get it out of the ground with an EV. You get it out of the ground with a giant earth mover that, burns a lot of energy. You may have to, clear a forest to get to some of these resources. You may have to have, labor that's not exactly treated well in Africa to get some cobalt out of the ground, or, like, there's a lot of that part of the narrative that everyone just overlooks, obviously. But and I'm, hey, I'm not saying we shouldn't try to, reduce emissions. Yeah, I'm a big fan of nuclear for that reason. I'm a big fan of natural gas for that reason. It's infinitely better than burning coal. Like, people that defend coal, like, I can get on board with not defending coal, but I think to get from, to get from coal to a bunch of renewables, you kind of have to go the smart way. And the same with EVs, like, the smart way is probably to use more plug-in hybrids. Everyone wants to go all the way to zero, and that's not the best way to manage, emissions. And one of the only countries in the world that's really done great with their emissions is the United States. And the reason is because we've replaced most of our coal with natural gas. But a lot of these activists and politicians, want to go straight to just wind and solar, even though they don't really produce that much energy, and they also still take a lot of, you got to build, windmills out of steel. Like, that stuff isn't, and then it's not very recyclable after, so you just scrap it. And they don't have that long of lives. They take up shocking amount of acreage to make the same amount of energy that you get from just one nuclear plant. So I think a lot of this is going to get sort of exposed in the years to come, and people will realize a lot of what they thought was a good idea for moving forward in a greener way, it wasn't the way to go. And the other thing I want to say real quick on that is, you know, here in the U.S., you know, like we're a really wealthy country, so we can, it's kind of a luxury we can have to be like, you know what, like maybe we should have some more electric vehicles and some more wind farms. But if you're, you know, if you're in Bangladesh and you're trying to go from living on 8 cents a day to living on $12 a day here in the next couple of decades or something, like it's not really a luxury you can afford. Like you still have to, you know, you're gonna have to use fossil fuel because that's what you can actually afford. You know, you can't afford a Tesla in Bangladesh, but you can afford, you know, a little diesel car maybe as an aspirational move. And I think in the West we get a little cocky about, you know, like, hey, everyone should just use windmills. Like, well, not everyone can afford that.
No, it's, and I think you get to a bigger issue in this topic, and it's something that has been both frustrating to me as an investor, and also just maddening on a rational basis, on a just a basis of, you know, just normal rationale, common sense thinking. You know, if you bring up natural gas as an alternative, you know, people are, yeah, it's still a fossil fuel. And you go, guys, hold on a second. Look what you, okay, yes, maybe there's still, you know, what I think natural gas, and correct me if I'm wrong, you might know this, but I want to say that burning natural gas is like 96% cleaner than oil, like 97-98% cleaner than coal, something like that. Does that sound right?
I can't remember the numbers, but it's at least double as clean as coal. Like at least, I think it's way more, like you're saying.
Well, the other thing too, and if we've got some green energy fans at home or listening, you know, the proof to me would be, hey, go into your kitchen right now, turn on all five of your gas burners, let them crank for a good 3 or 4 hours, and tell me if you notice a degradation of air quality in your home. Right.
Yeah.
What else can you burn in your home where you don't smell it, you know, you don't see smoke, anything, and yet they're all willing to rip down sides of mountains to get the you know, the rare earth and all that other kind of stuff that they need.
Yeah,
they're all okay with continuing to mine coal to make solar panels, you know, and you look at them and go, guys, what is the net effect? Like, I look at one of the biggest tickets to me, and I know that you're on board with this, and you've actually helped illuminate me or illuminate my thinking as it relates to this, is I'm like, guys, we have a green energy revolution, and we're literally floating on top of it in this country. It's natural gas. If you want to get to less emissions and less harm, the only real feasible way to do that, in my opinion, is via nuclear and natural gas. What is this? How does natural gas get left out of this? How does it get thrown into the same bucket as coal and oil when it's not at all? I mean, I just look at, if you really want to transition to a clean grid, you're not going to get there without natural gas and nuclear, and yet they're opposed to that too.
Yeah, the nuclear one's even more egregious because it's actually zero,
right,
you know, emissions, and a lot of the climate, whatever you want to call it, lobby is even against it. And that tells me you're not serious, because, like, yes, you'll have to go get the uranium out of the ground, but other than that, like, that's about it. And it creates, you know, if anyone that's played SimCity back in the day will know, it creates a lot of energy compared to these other forms.
Well, and Chase, correct me if I'm wrong too, because people are like, well, you got to mine the uranium, so that's just as bad as mining coal. You so much less earth needs to be disrupted to fulfill the uranium
Absolutely.
Needs of this world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even close, right?
Yeah, ISR mining means you don't have to just go, you know, crazy open pit, or like whether it's underground or, you know, above. Like there's pretty reasonable ways to get that out of the ground. So
yeah, it's that whole, and again, this is the market, and I, you know, we could sit here and do a 2-hour philosophical discussion on this, but it just continues to amaze me how long narrative has been driving asset prices, and how it continues to, and how nobody cares, right? You know, I invested, you know, and I beat up on Tesla, but, oh, I invested in Tesla because I knew their business was going to boom and they're going to make tons of money. You look at them and go, they are not making money, right? Your whole narrative, right? That's the other thing that cracks me up about the Kathy Woods of the world. Go look at their projections on these green energy plays like Tesla 5 years ago. They haven't even come close to the projections these people have made. And yet,
right,
the stock prices, those projections have. You don't need the facts backing you up in this economy or in this marketplace. It's just fascinating to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think, and again, the philosophical bent, I've spent a lot of, probably too much time thinking about how that's possible. And the thing I keep coming back to is that unlike any other time in the world, now I know people have gotten away from it that civilizations that have, you know, relied on currency degradation and they eventually pay the price. But the thing I keep coming back to is I really think it has to do something with living in the age of central bankers, being able to conjure money out of thin air. I just see that as sort of being the zero gravity button where, you know, if we can just conjure money out of thin air, if we can shut down an economy and see a 25% to 30%, you know, drop in economic activity in the space of 4 weeks, and then we can just create money out of thin air and fill in the hole and run. Do you think that's what? So I guess the question I'm getting to, and it's a little bit, again, more on the philosophical side. Do you think that is the big wind in the sails of this narrative driven market? The fact that you're living in the age of central banks and conjured money, or is it just classic bubble behavior? Am I digging too deep? I guess the question I'd ask.
To me, central banks play a big role here because rates are where they are largely because of what they've done. But I think, you know, we've printed trillions of dollars. And despite that fact, you know, oil went to negative. So when I think about it that way, you know, versus the Tesla that went parabolic, even though they, you know, weren't really even doing anything with their sales. So that's when I have to realize, like, okay, so like obviously everything just doesn't float on, you know, the tide of central bank money printing. Only some things do. And then, you know, you start realizing, you know, we live in a world that has almost no growth, especially this year, clearly. So if you want to buy something that's growing, then you have to pay more than, you know, would be normal. And I think just that need for the only few things that are growing just drove people to pay crazy prices. And then for whatever reason, the way we just discount future growth is just we compare it to some guesses about interest rates that everyone thinks are going to be zero for forever. So if you think, you know, if you think the discount rate is going to be nothing for perpetuity, then all of a sudden you can say, hey, there are future cash flows that I think are coming, which all is just a giant guess, are worth infinity. And then you can just, you know, trick yourself into plugging that into a model and thinking that's how the real world works. And it, obviously it just isn't. And that's created this just monumental disconnect between, you know, the things that have been growing and got priced to infinity and the things that haven't been growing that, you know, like an oil company that is trading, or a natural gas company, or a lot of different kind of real asset plays that are, you know, they're valued like they're probably just going to go into business soon.
Right. And that's another irony is you start looking at the balance sheets and the cash flow statements, and you're sitting there going, the things that are priced as if they're going out of business are actually in pretty good shape, by and large.
Yeah, they're the ones that will pay you a dividend next year.
Right. And the things that they're bidding to the moon are negative. I mean, it's just absurd.
Yeah, the one that's bid to the moon is probably gonna have to sell some stock and dilute you next year because they don't even make money. So.
I know, but look, we're living in the age of stock splits or where you get shares for free. I mean, no one cares if they're selling stock. These people aren't worried about dilution.
Yeah, and in that sense, we are, and obviously, like in pockets of the market, we're obviously in, like, you know, just bona fide bubble territory. You see all the signs and the behaviors of you know, like some of the biggest bubbles in history, where the everyman is all of a sudden on board and making money. Like you look at, you know, you see, I'm sure the charts where, you know, just the average guy trading in his basement is crushing hedge funds this year. That's a good sign, you know, that you're in a just total speculative fever. That doesn't mean when that pops, like it takes everything with it. Like a lot of the things that haven't done great are going to be fine. But I think there are definitely pockets that if interest rates are able to move, you know, enough higher than a lot of these trades that made your neighbor rich, you know, they're those all of a sudden are going to have problems.
Yeah. I've got a funny anecdotal story, and if he's listening to the show, if he's listening to the show, he knows I love him. But I got a guy that I work with, is a personal trainer, become a good friend, great guy, played in the NFL for a little bit, and just he destroys me and tortures me physically 3 times a week. And I'm helping him out with stock picks. So I was telling he and his brother about this speculative SPAC play that came out. It had to do with, you know, clean energy. You and I have discussed it. And I just said, hey, throw a little bit at this. It's completely nonsense, but the thing's probably going to double or triple in the next, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. So he calls me yesterday freaking out because the stock popped yesterday 93% or something like that. And the way he and his brother played it, both of them put 25% of their entire portfolio, half cash, half options in the thing, and just levered up to the moon. And he called me and he's like, my portfolio is up 30% today. And this is anecdotal. It's one off. But I'm hearing these stories constantly. These people are fearless. And they're buying, you know, they're loading up on call options. And I'm texting back and forth with him yesterday. And I'm like, hey, where is the strike price of your options? And he's like, well, the break. Anyway, I realized, and I should have known it going into it, but they don't even have a clue how the options work. It's just the level of speculation and bulletproof feeling out there is just, it's incredible to me. And that leads me into another thing I wanted to talk to you about. Last week we did a section on the show that was focused on, I think the name of the segment was The Tail Wagging the Dog. And we had done some work, and other people have too, piggybacking off a lot of work that other people have done. But looking at the options market and looking at how dominant it has become, and one of the things that appears to me, and again, interacting with retail constantly, seeing this, the involvement in the options market of retail is like nothing I've ever seen. And that it really looks to me like that speculative frenzy in options is one of the biggest drivers in the market. And that's never been the case, right? Options, you know, we've all grown up and in the industry watching that, you know, options are a derivative, right? They're a one-off. You know, they are driven by what the underlying market is doing. It appears to me, and it appears to other people that are smarter than I am, that have done great work on this, that the tail is wagging the dog, that the options market is now driving the equity market. What are your thoughts on that? Have you done work on that? And do you think that that's an explanation for a lot of these crazy moves?
Yeah, I would say it really has been for like the last, I don't know, whatever it's been, like 3 months or so. But if you dig into the data now, a lot of that has come off. A lot of the fever is really broken on that. I think, you know, what probably happened is people learned the hard way how options actually work. And most of it was chasing, you know, a lot of the big tech stocks, the popular ones, that ones, you know, where everyone's Peter Lynch and they're like, well, I have an iPhone, it's cool, so I'll buy Apple. And I think, but a lot of those stocks kind of went sideways about the time everyone bought, you know, YOLO calls on them. And then, you know, a lot of people got smoked out and they realized the hard way that, you know, if you hold to expiration and your stock didn't go anywhere, that's very bad for your bottom line. So obviously that was a big, big story this year, but I think a lot of those people got hurt on the retail side and I think that will probably largely go away, you know, in the years ahead. But it was definitely something to behold this year. And the overall just kind of story of retail just being such a, you know, big part of the market this year is significant. And I know I've always read, you know, that's kind of what you see, you know, at kind of major speculative tops is where retail just is all in. And, you know, I wasn't around for the 99-2000. I was in high school, so I wasn't really interested by then, you know. So I've read and heard a lot of stories about that speculative, you know, mania. But I think we just saw something very similar. And when it comes to like these EV SPACs and everything, you know, I think we're still watching, you know, the same kind of behavior. But as far as the options market goes, I think that will cool off moving forward. But it definitely was a big part of the story, and it was the tail wagging the dog because dealers had to just go out and buy tons and tons of stock to hedge that out, and then that definitely moved the market.
Yeah, the longer I've been in this business, the less a fan I am of historical analogs, because you know, everybody knows it's always different. It's never identical. Now, I wasn't an investor back in the tech bubble, but again, growing up in a brokerage firm and being fascinated by stocks and being involved every day, you know, I watched it. I wasn't a participant per se, but I watched that 99-2000 bubble up close. You know, heard my dad and the guys in the office constantly going, "This is insane." You know, I remember the clients freaking out, calling about, "You got to buy that." You know, to me, my memories of that and going through that from my perspective, I didn't think I'd see that level of mania again in the general stock market. I knew you'd see it in pockets, but that to me is the only thing to compare what we are currently seeing. The type of thinking, the belief that earnings no longer matter, which I hear a lot of these people say, the comparisons. There are differences, and don't get me wrong. There are differences. For instance, I think the EV market is an absolute dead ringer for the tech bubble in 99. I think it is this tech bubble, right? And I think it is. I think the tech bubble. I do think there's a tech bubble right now, in the broader sense. But one of the big differences between the tech bubble we've got today and the one we had in the late 90s is the one in the late 90s was anticipating the role that tech is now playing, right? So there's been fruition there. Having said that, again, the prices they've bid this stuff up to that any traditional investor goes, you know, you look at the company and you go, "Yeah, I think it's a great company. Well, why don't you buy the stock?" And I'm like, "Because you have 10 to 15 years of flawless execution priced into the thing already." Right. Yeah. But the analogs to 99, it is shocking to me. It's so similar. The bulletproof mentality, the belief that the Buffetts and the Druckenmillers are idiots, you know, you hear the and you're hearing that din, you know, growing every single day, and the new market gurus, right? The flows. Have you looked at the flows going into Cathie Wood's ARK ETFs?
Yeah, I've seen that. The recent days, Eric Bakunis has like put those up, and it's wild.
It is the only ETF family out there that is even close to their flows is Vanguard.
Right. Just crazy.
And there, I mean, that is a dead ringer for tech. I was actually having little Christmas, Abraham Christmas get together last night. And I was talking to my uncle who ran a brokerage firm down in South America in Panama, has since sold it. But he was running through the '90s, you know, he was there in the tech bubble. And he was telling me stories about how they'd go to these Janus conferences. Remember the Janus 20 and the Janus Tech Funds? They were kind of the ARK Invest of that day.
Right.
And you know, they're going, and the 27-year-old money manager pulls up in his bright green Lamborghini, and he only has 2 minutes to talk to individual investors because he's a rock star. The similarities are just striking, right? This attitude of it's a new age. You know, traditional investing, you people don't get it, and I have tremendous respect for this guy, especially on an intellectual level. But literally, those exact words have come out of Chamath. You know, Chamath Palpatia, I think is his name.
Right.
Brilliant guy, brilliant investor. I don't know if you saw that tweet the other day. It was like, if you'd listened to me this year and bought stocks when I told you, you'd be up 355%. And I'm just sitting there going, yeah, Chamath, and that's because you're so brilliant, right? You're going to crank out triple-digit returns from here into perpetuity, correct? It's just...
He's putting out SPACs at perpetuity. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, no, he is. He's it's SPAC.
He's capitalizing. Yeah.
It's spectacular. How do you like that? That's my corny my corny phrase of the day. No, it's just the level of magical thinking out there is just it's absolutely stupendous. And maybe it's just like any other classic bubble that it's just going to kind of peter itself out and just kind of, you know, go away. But I just get the nagging feeling that we haven't seen the heights of ridiculousness or the heights of how ridiculous and insane this can all get.
I tell you, if rates don't move higher when the economy starts getting hot and inflation starts moving, you know, whether that's the Fed, you know, pinning it down and buying enough to where they don't move, or whatever the case is, or it just happens naturally because no one wants to sell them. If that happens that way, then there, I mean, this rocket is, you know, it's about to just go to the second stage booster and just go faster. It really, at least in my opinion, really all comes back to rates. If they're allowed to move higher, then especially all this tech focused, you know, the bubbles will, they'll all, you know, whether they burst, you know, in really dramatic fashion or they just kind of leak lower for the next decade, I don't know. But that's really kind of what it all comes down to for me. And the same, you know, on the flip side of that, all the things, you know, that are the opposite, that look free, will become expensive again.
Okay, and I'm with you, and I get your point on rates, and I agree with you. But at the same time, if rates do float up and that begins to cause an issue, we know what they're going to do, right? They'll put in curve control if they have to, or yield curve control. They'll buy up trade. I don't see how that's going to possibly get out of hand.
So I agree to an extent. I think, to me, it really comes down to, I think the Fed cares about real rates. As long as real rates stay negative, I think they won't really care if especially at the long end. They're not going to let the two year move. Like they'll buy all the 2 years in existence if they have to. But I think if the 30-year starts to move, I think they'll manage it. I don't think they'll let it move too fast, but I think they'll let it move. I think it would be healthy for the economy, even in, through their eyes, if that were to move, you know, in a orderly fashion. If rates were to move higher on the long end, they can't let it go too crazy because then it would, you know, it would crash housing and a bunch of other things. But I think it's in their best interest to let it move, you know, enough to steepen the yield curve to where banks can actually make money, so they don't have to babysit banks as closely. Things like that, but they can't let real rates really, you know, those can't, we literally can't afford to let those go, you know, positive, especially quickly or high, you know, or much.
Hey, well, one of the things that we've talked about, and you can feel free to disagree with me. One of the things that we, and this reminds me of that, one of the things that we have said on this show many times is that we believe that the dollar and the whole situation as it relates to monetary policy and to some extent even fiscal policy, I view that, or what I've called it, as I've said, I believe that that situation is terminal. Now, and what I mean by that is not terminal as in we're on the edge of a dollar collapse and I think we're going to be looking at hyperinflation. What I mean, though, is that they, in my opinion, this economy is so out of line with historical norms, so bloated with debt, such unsustainably and ridiculously and artificially low rates, that I don't think you're going to see us get to a point where you don't need constant central bank intervention to keep the thing on the road. And what I mean by that is they have tinkered so much, right? They do one thing and that creates an outcome that they like, but it creates, you know, three other unforeseen, you know, byproducts, and then they've got to play whack-a-mole with those. And then it seems like every intervention creates three or four more issues that they have to deal with. I just don't think you're ever going to see them get to a place where they're not having to constantly use bubble gum and shoestring to keep this thing on the road. Do you agree with that? Or do you think that they'll be able to actually take their hands off the seat of the bike and let the kid, you know, do it on his own?
So it depends on, I mean, it all depends on fiscal policy. So they will have to use every trick in the book and invent new tricks if we don't get much, you know, fiscal spending. If we do get enough fiscal spending, they can, I think they actually, in a lot of ways, can kind of let their hands off, but to an extent. So let's say the fiscal response is just massive for the next 5 years in a row. And let's say growth is like 5-6%, inflation's, you know, 3-6% itself. You know, unemployment's 1%, wages are moving higher. Like we're in a, you know, what I would refer to as an inflationary boom at that point. Now, that's not easy to pull off. But let's say we did that. Let's say we were so irresponsible with fiscal that we got a real boom and it was inflationary. In that scenario, I think the Fed can just, you know, they can raise rates, as long as they don't raise them, you know, past inflation or growth. and they can kind of let, you know, a lot of things reset. That gives them the room to actually, in some ways, normalize. But if we don't get that spending, and you know, you're getting growth at 1.5%, and inflation struggling, and still it can't get to 2%. So no matter what they say and do, they're, you know, they're trapped in what we've been trapped in the last decade, but worse. Then, you know, not only do they have to consider negative rates, they have to buy all the bonds, you know, that are basically out there. They have to kind of take a page out of Europe's book and start going to dual rates, where they're essentially paying banks to lend people money, or something similar. So really, it just comes down to how, you know, will the fiscal authority do what is needed to get growth and inflation? If yes, central banks can back away. If no, central banks have to double down on what they've done.
Yeah, I get that, and I get it on the stimulative front. I just think that. I don't know, man. I think that there are so many. It's what I've called before, this like a Frankenstein economy, you know, where so many things are outside of historical norms. I don't think there. You know, for instance, I could see a scenario where you've got a quote unquote inflationary boom, you've got the Fed raising rates to counterbalance the inflationary boom, and yet at the same time they're buying corporates to keep corporate yield. Now I realize they're not in there buying corporates hand over fist. I get that. But I'm just saying, I could see a scenario where you've got those things, they're letting rates drift higher, but then they're still using, you know, the they've still got plenty of ammo left in that SPV that the Treasury's in control of. But, you know, then I think that they'd have to buy down corporate rates just because of the level of debt on the balance sheet. I mean, even if you get back to 3.5, 4% growth next year, you know, which I don't think 4% growth is sustainable unless it's inflationary, you know, driven
right,
via
right.
inflation. But even if you get back there, when you look at the amount of debt on these corporate balance sheets, you could see a scenario where, you know, the economy is growing by 3 and 5%. But if rates are rising, corporate profits could be dropping in that environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's healthy. I think, you know, I think a lot of like, you know, Austrians or like kind of conservative financial thinkers, like, they view like this inflation as like the worst outcome. They view, you know, this inflationary boom that's pushed by, you know, government spending is terrible. But they also view, you know, these zombie companies and all this support that the monetary authorities have to give is also terrible. I think if you allow this inflationary boom pushed by fiscal spending, then you can actually undo some of those other problems that to me are kind of worse, where you can let some of these zombie companies actually go, you know, get killed by higher rates. You can kind of flip the way corporations work, where, you know, instead of borrowing money to buy back your stock, you know, you definitely wouldn't be doing that in this kind of environment. You know, you would, if anything, you would be borrowing money to put into your business again, you know, crazy thought, capital expenditure to grow your business and make it better. And then, you know, that could even feed into productivity growth, which, you know, we desperately need. So I think, it seems weird to think of like government spending, you know, to generate growth and inflation as like the answer to some of these underlying problems we all see. But I think to an extent it could be. But, you know, to your point, like that is going to crack a lot of levered companies. But to me, that's where something, whenever things get, you know, a little better, the Fed should start communicating like, we're going to let you burn down if you don't take care of your balance sheet. Like, we're going to let rates go up. And that's going to be your problem.
Well,
now,
know,
they probably won't ever do that. I get it. But in my perfect world, they would.
Oh, me. Yeah. Me too. It just seems like they are trying to block or mute out any natural ramifications for companies that are horribly managing their own balance sheets. And it's not just them. You know, it's the U.S. government. I think it's an absolute sham what they did with the airlines. It's amazing how they spun that narrative. I've had to have this conversation with so many clients who've called frustrated and been like, what did you want? All those people to lose their jobs? And I go, guys, no, that's not the alternative. They weren't saving jobs. They were saving investors, you know?
Yeah, they bailed out rich investors, not the company, not the company's employees. Like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and then it comes to corporate, the you know, buying corporate debt. Their clients are like, well, yeah, but they got to fund those companies. They can't let them go out of business. And I go, guys, they're buying the debt on the open market. That money isn't going to the companies. It's going to the investors.
Yeah. And they can let their investors go out of business.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, That's probably, if you could buy stock in a, if you could buy stock in a hedge fund, I would be loaded up on Bridgewater and Citadel right now, because, you know, where, I could be being a little bit conspiratorial here. I don't think I am, but, you know, I think there's a reason that they pay ex FOMC members to be advisors for them and pay them, you know, $2 to $4 million
a
year. You know, they've, it was amazing how they jumped in there and started buying up corporates. And I'm like, does this have anything to do with risk parity strategies these guys are running? Anyway,
yeah, who they can sell them to. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Anyway, Powell, well, hey, we've taken up enough of your time. Going into 2021, outside of the oil and nat gas stuff that I think we've covered in pretty good, you know, pretty well. What other things are you looking at? What other opportunities do you see that you think that people are by and large ignoring?
So those are energy is the biggest for me. So oil and natural gas, of course, as well as uranium, which uranium has been catching fire lately, which is always uncomfortable whenever your idea starts to really work. But in addition to that, though, agriculture is an area that is not getting a lot of attention, I don't think, and it should. Whether it's you know, the dollar going down, it's the growing population, it's weather events. We've had really good weather for, you know, the last decade. So you've had a lot of prices, you know, really low because everyone's produced all they need and more. So we're getting to the situation with natural gas, as well as a lot of grains and other crops, where if you get some weather problems, you know, you could really see prices move. I think we're about to see that in coffee, for instance, where some of the weather issues are going to create some big movements. But even if weather was still good, you know, just the dollar going down, just the fact that all these agricultural commodities were just so beaten down over the last decade, I think it's going to be a really great place. And they've already moved, you know, a good bit, but I think over the next decade, being involved in agriculture is going to be just a must for people that want to kind of hedge, especially, you know, the bubbles that are out there and EVs and tech and stuff. If you want a place to hide away from those kinds of things whenever they crack, you know, assuming they do, then I think energy, agriculture are going to be important.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if they, you know, I don't know if they crack, man. I was reading, you know, like some Kathy Wood prognostications, and you got to take her serious, you know.
Yeah.
We're forecasting $2.5-3 trillion market cap based on expected 2040 sales for Tesla, man. So
speaking of, one thing I'll tell your audience, you know, like, you know, if you're kind of on the fringes of this stuff, if you're not, you know, like, if finance isn't what you do for a living, I think people can kind of put a halo effect on people that are in this industry and think, oh, these people are all super geniuses. You know, they all went to like Ivy League schools. You know, they wear silk ties. They know everything. What the reality is, if you look at the way Wall Street works, it's really just a bunch of people extrapolating what's going on in the last 5 years all the way into the future and deciding that's going to be what happens. It's really something to behold to watch the way people extrapolate everything that's going on in the last 5 years or 10 years. And there's just enormous opportunities because that's the way human beings work.
Well, I'm just waiting for those opportunities to pay, pal. and we've had a good year, no complaints. But I just, you know, I'm a human like everybody else, and I'm proud of the performance we put up this year, especially, you know, the way we manage volatility during the downturn. But, you know, I was sitting there talking to a client of mine. I got a client in his personal trading account who's up 140% year to date. You know, and I'm just sitting there going, man, you know, we used to have some kind of advantage, you know, doing the work, doing the you know, actual analysis and research used to mean something. It just doesn't. So I'm certainly looking forward to getting things back there. Well, anyway, Chase, thanks again for coming on. For people that want to follow Chase on Twitter, he posts all kinds of great research, which is funny enough, that is how he and I met. And so you can follow him on Twitter at Pinecone Macro. And then another thing that if you are interested in investing and you manage some of your own money, what is the baseline cost to subscribe to your entry level product that's great for retail people to give them a macro overview?
Yeah, that one is $33 a month, and you know, my clients, even for the $33 a month letter, that my clients range from people trading in their mom's basement, you know, to hedge funds and family offices. I just try to keep it accessible to everyone because I was that guy that had, you know, a limited research budget whenever I got into this game. So I try to keep it accessible to everybody.
Yeah, it's great value, and they can get it at pineconemacro.com. Isn't that the name of the website?
Absolutely. And if you want to, you know, a couple free ones to look at, you can just hit me up on Twitter or email me, and I'll be happy to send you a couple for free. Even if you know you're not going to subscribe, it's fine.
Well, and then you also give trade recommendations. I got to tell you, man, I always hate to do this because I feel like I'm setting up somebody, you know, like, but you've had some great calls, man. There's been some big money made on some of those trade recommendations this year, and you've really drilled a couple of the turning points in some of these markets. So again, for $33 a month, I think it's some of the best value out there on the research. So I know it's a valuable part of what we do, Chase, and hopefully you know how grateful we are for it. And it's been great working with you, and happy to put this year behind us, man. And hopefully, and oh, by the way, the little girl is 6 months old. Is that today?
That is today. Yep.
Oh, look at that, man. Just getting closer and closer to those teenage years, buddy.
Don't say that.
Anyway, well, hey, you and your family have a wonderful, wonderful Christmas and holiday season, and a happy new year. And we'll get back to it at the beginning of the year. And all of you guys, thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for joining us. Have a wonderful Christmas and weekend. And we will be back next week. Thanks for listening. This is Know Your Risk Radio podcast on Know Your Risk Radio.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.